motherfucker. What's up, nigga? Gangsta rap, nigga. Nigga. Nigga, 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 nigga. I'm 100% nigga. Nigga, 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 nigga. I'm 200% nigga. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why do police hate niggas? Nigga, 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 nigga. They hate us cause my dicks is bigger. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why do you call yourself a nigga? Nigga, 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 nigga. Cause I'm a motherfucking nigga. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why you drink so much beer? Nigga, 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 nigga. I don't drink beer, I drink more liquor. Cause I'm a nigga. Motherfucking nigga, man. I ain't all that African American shit. Fuck that. I'm a nigga. I ain't mixed. I'm a nigga. N-I-G-G-A. Nigga. You already know. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why you eat so much chicken? Nigga, 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 nigga. Why would you naked in my kitchen? Nigga, 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 nigga. Why you calling hoes bitches? Nigga, 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 nigga. Cause them hoes is bitches. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why you stay in the hood? Nigga, 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 nigga. Cause I don't like living by Peckerwood. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why you ain't got no job? Nigga, 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 nigga. $7 an hour will be my dog. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why your pants got a sag? Nigga, 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 nigga. Cause hand-me-down was all a nigga had. Nigga, 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 nigga. Why you scared to go to coke? Shit, cause it does look just like that motherfucker that put our asses on the boat and made me a nigga. Mama Rag is a nigga. Do-rag is a nigga. Ballistics is a nigga. And I'm Eureka's nigga. Nigga.
Good morning, boys and girls. It is actually it's 12:27 or 11:27 here in the Eastern Standard Zone, and it's January 17th, 2017. How about that? I almost got stuck on that. And we're here at the bunker, and it's overcast. We've had fog and rain. I had to drive almost 100 miles last night to pick up my lady at the airport, and it was raining cats and dogs and fog too. It'd be fog for a while, ground fog, and then rain. So semis were about blowing me off the road, but we made it, so we're here. P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana 46581. That's where you send your moolah, and several of you people have got your donations in already, and that's fine. Great. So I went out yesterday and got me some money orders, and so I'll sit down sometime today after the show and make the money orders out to the POWs. Well, I see Congressman Lewis, that little midget nigger down from Georgia, whose claim to fame was he was defying the law on the Pettus Bridge back in the, what, 50s it was? And he must have been just a kid, and he would have been a skinny little kid. Now he's a fat, short little fart, trying to make a big deal. His claim to fame was marching and defying the cops, and he got his head beat. Serves him right. And now he's trying to give the President Trump trouble. But Trump ain't going to take that shit. He's an ugly little ape-looking Negro. The only thing he's missing is the hair all over his body. So anyhow, we have let these Negroes go too far. And it's the white people's fault. It's the white people who coddle these Negroes and Negroes and Negroes, and now they don't want to give up being coddled. And they're getting wilder and wilder and wilder, and that's good, because that's the chaos factor. It always leads to the same thing. Remember, things started out as a monarch, and then a republic, and then so-called democracy, and then the next rule is anarchy and so forth like that. So it always goes this cycle, and we're getting towards the end of the cycle. Not the unicycle, the political cycle. So anyhow, that's you can predict it like the time of day. It's like it's just the way it is, boys and girls, that and it happens the same way almost every time with the treatment of people. When people want their rights, and that's good, but then they want more than their rights. Then they want your rights and my rights. I hear them on the radio once in a while, and they say, it's, what is it? Let me think here. Is it the immutable truth? All men are created equal? Well, that's bullshit, and you know it if you listen to it carefully. Now, that's not the exact way. Let me look it up. Oh, yeah, we find these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Now, the person who wrote that, I don't give a shit whether he was a founding father or not, was nuts. I know why they did it, because France was going through that crazy-ass revolution of theirs, and liberty, fraternity, equality, and all that shit. And we were sucking up to the French to get weapons to fight the revolution. So we'd say about anything, I guess. Well, anyhow, we find these truths. Well, you haven't proven with evidence that it's true. We find these truths, and then even worse, to compound it, self-evident. It's not self-evident at all. It's totally non-self-evident. And then finally, the third lie, all men are created equal. So you got three lies in one sentence. And nobody can prove any of these things is correct or true. But we've been living with this shit for a long time. And it's been a very bad thing for the white race. And until we get start all over and grab people by the lapels, put them up against the wall and say, it's not a truth, it's not immutable, that men, all men are created equal. That's it, you dumbass. Get that through your dumb Republican, Democrat, middle of the roader, whatever, head. How many people have read that really closely and dissected it? I mean, it's absolutely crazy. It makes no sense. We find these truths or these lies to be self-evident, that no man is created equal, no race is created equal, no animal is created equal, and so on and so on. Make sure your kids and grandchildren understand that. Once you get that straightened out, everything else is pretty simple. I can imagine what the King of England, King George, said when he was presented with the draft of the Declaration of Independence. The guy said, would tell him, Your Highness, read down this section right here where it says about all this equality stuff, that all men are created equal and all that. The king would have probably said, they've been talking to those crazy-ass Frenchmen again. We always knew those Frenchmen were nuts. The Germans found it out. Yeah. What the hell is this stuff? The king would say. Are those guys going bat crazy? Because nobody really in the history of man has ever believed that. In reality, if you read all the evidence and what went on during that, before the revolution, and the connections between the king and the colonists and all that, you'll find it was another really useless war. And there was bullshit on both sides. But in reality, it was just a transfer of property. The ruling class of England lost the property to the new ruling class in America, but still, it wasn't that new, because there was the same bankers came flooding into the colonies, and it was about the same game, ruling class to ruling class. That's what you got to understand. If you don't understand that, you're not understanding anything, how ridiculous all these wars are. It's all about follow the money. Follow the money. In this country, the Democrat and Republican Party were set up as a vaudeville act just to keep you occupied and worried and thinking you could change things by going from one to the other. Well, I've told you many times, I'll tell you again, that's like going to Las Vegas and going to one casino and lose your ass and say, well, I'm not going to stay here and gamble anymore in this goddamn place. So you go across the street to the other casino and proceed to lose your ass again until you've lost your total ass. So you can't. The game is fixed in Vegas, it's fixed in Washington. And the only way to escape it is, what is it? Yeah, Operation Chaos. Now put your hands on the monitor. Put your two hands on the front of the monitor, and you got them on there? Well, I'm telling you, you're now recruited into the Operation Chaos Central Command. Go forth and occupy. The parties are so funny because everybody's talking about, oh, it's terrible. There's division in the country. It's divisive. Anybody's divisive is un-American. It's terrible. It's terrible. We're split right down the middle. It's getting worse, and I don't know what's going to happen. My great Republican Party is crumbling. If not now, it will. The Democrats, it's crumbling. Well, don't worry. The ruling class will give you something new to play with. But division and true diversity is what you want. The more screwed up and divided the ruling class functionaries are, the better it is for you. So you should, if you're going to pray to Thor or Odin, or whatever, just not a spook in the sky, well then you'll pray for a division, revolution, might is right. But you've got to learn to not go along with these bastards when they want you to worry and fight and spend your money and go off to war for the corporations, the ruling class. Tell them to go fuck themselves. That should be our motto from now on. Hey, ruling class, go fuck yourself. Now, we're going to have a lot of fun come up this weekend. I got my beer ready, my popcorn ready, television's all warmed up. Because hopefully they'll tear Washington to pieces. Hundreds of thousands of these screaming leftists who are gaining nothing by demonstrating. In fact, that helps Trump, because if he has to, he'll turn out the military. All this stuff plays into the hands of the ruling class. And the leftists are so stupid, the progressives, you know, because they think they know what a perfect world is, and they've set out to get it, and Donald Trump is screwing them up. He's a speed bump along the way, and they ain't gonna take that shit no more. They're just totally, totally coming apart at the seams. And I hope they come there by the hundreds of thousands and tear Washington down. And I can watch it on my little old big screen. Wouldn't that be something if they stormed the main stage and grabbed Trump and toted him off for some place and then demanded some kind of concessions and all that? It could be the start of a revolution. But I'd recommend to boys and girls, don't go down there, please, for your own well-being. Let them tear each other to pieces. Let them tear the place to pieces. That works in our favor. Yeah. You think I'm crazy? No, I'm crazy like a fox. I know what the fuck is going on. I think that Duke ought to go down there and try to reason with the progressives at Washington. That's what I'd like to see. Well, here's a little bit of scuttlebutt. I'm not sure whether it's true or not. Does the key media neo-Nazi, hitherto anonymous, live on the Upper East Side of Manhattan with his Jewish wife? That's what reports from rival racist factions in the broader alt-right movement indicate. Mike Enoch, head of neo-Nazi site The Right Stuff that puts out the Daily Shoah and Fash the Nation podcast, which also most famously developed the Zero Echoes plugin, has been exposed as Mike Pienovich, a software developer originally from Montclair, New Jersey. By judicious removal of letters of his family name, Pienovich reportedly becomes Enoch, an allusion to British racial separatist politician Enoch Powell. Nothing in the world of the alt-right agglomeration of misogynists, anti-Semites, and white supremacists is ever quite as it seems. What seems to have happened, though, is the resulting from a clash on Red Ice Radio, none of these people I've heard of, about whether the members should even speak to Jews. The Right Stuff crew got into a spat with the 8-channel group called Baphomet. Well, all this stuff is Greek to me. Baphomet responded by attacking the TRS site as well as revealing names, addresses, and families of a number of key synonymous members of the alt-right, including Enoch, who seems to have admitted the accusation. Well, that's a confusing bit of information, because I don't know any of these people. Well, the CIA director, John Brennan, branded President-elect Donald Trump as outrageous for comparing the American intelligence community to Nazi Germany. Well, that's impossible because the intelligence community of Nazi Germany was much better than the one in Washington. Quote, "What I do find outrageous is equating intelligence community with Nazi Germany," Brennan said on Fox News Sunday. "I do take great umbrage at that." Well, I'll tell you, your CIA and so forth have committed far more atrocities than the Germans ever thought of. Brennan, who is leaving his post when Trump takes office, also defended the intelligence chief's decision to share the explosive information with the incoming president and President Obama. Quote, "Bringing to attention of the president-elect as well as the current president that this information was out there was a responsibility in the mind of the intelligence directors of intelligence community," Brennan said. Well, leave Trump alone. So he got some nookie over in Russia. What's your big problem? All of you guys, if you went over there and were offered broads, you'd take them too. What a bunch of hypocrites. The trouble is with all these nerds in Washington that talk tough and talk about whipping Russia and all that, I doubt whether they could get it up. Well, run for the hills, Hollywood Nazis. Is Twitter plagued with Nazis? That's what an anonymous change.org petition is charging. listing information on hundreds of Nazis and white supremacist accounts and demanding the social media platform boot them off. Quote, Twitter is brimming with active Nazis who use their platform as a tool to recruit vast numbers of people who are probably going to show up at the inauguration in mass, in uniform, with flags, hobnail boots, to spread hate and harass other users, reads the petition addressed to Twitter and the company's CEO, Jack Dorsey. Quote, we've gathered the top 500 Nazis and bot supremacist accounts on Twitter. We listed them and we'd like them to be gone. The petition was created in early January and as of February afternoon it had 168 supporters. None of them named. Twitter has seen a mass uptick in hate speech over the past year and recently introduced a number of new features to combat online abuse, such as a tool that lets users mute certain words, phrases, and usernames or hashtags. Twitter also removed a number of accounts associated with the white nationalist alt-right, such as white nationalist Richard Spencer in his Redax Journal, although Spencer account has since been restored. You shouldn't say that stuff, man. Responding to a query about the petition, a representative from Twitter wrote that the company would take action on accounts violating the Twitter rules, which prohibit violent threats, harassment, hateful conduct, and multiple account abuse. The petition calls for 500 Nazi scalps, a reference to the oft-quoted line in the 2009 film Inglourious Basterds. White nationalists mocked the petition online, joking among themselves about where their names appeared on the list, which ranks the accounts based on their numbers of followers. Well, I'm glad I don't have followers. I have comrades. I have friends. I have co-racists. Nathan D'Amigo, a leader of the white nationalist group Identity Europa, who in the hell is that? Boy, I'll tell you, they're popping up all over. Wrote back and forth with Steve Falco, a college student who says he opposes Black Lives Matter and leftists but supports cultural libertarianism and Western civilization and happens to be Jewish. Stevie Boy is Jewish. Steve Falco. This whole right wing has gone to hell in a handbag. I guess it always was to hell in a handbag, but it's getting to be a real zoo. I don't know about you, but I don't know hardly any National Socialists. There are lots of Hollywood Nazis all over the place. But I really don't. I don't run into a National Socialist of what a real National Socialist is hardly ever. You know, I can't understand this women's march for something, whatever it is. I see women in power all over the place. But even as it may, they don't have to march at all. They never did have to march. All they have to do is all the women cross their legs real tight for about 2 weeks, and they'd have the men running to them on bended knee. Now, if Trump would have been a homosexual, BuzzFeed wouldn't have talked about it at all, about his trip to Russia. If he'd have had homosexual affairs in Russia, you wouldn't see any of this in progressive news. But if he had sex with a woman, oh my God. See, the new right-wing racial star, Mr. Spencer, is saying that he wants to build a white ethnic state. Well, Mr. Spencer, let me give you a tip. Before you even think of building a white ethnic state, you better concern yourself with tearing down the rotten, corrupt mess that's here now. It's called white urban development. Well, I see they called off the search for that Malaysian airliner. MH370 officially called off after nearly 3 years of searching for the remains of the plane carrying 239 people to Beijing that disappeared in 2014. Probably an inside job. They spent millions looking for this plane. Unless that plane was loaded with gold, it was a complete waste of time. They go through the motions on all these things to make the relatives feel better, but in reality, might is right type situation. Once they were down to the bottom, there was nothing else to do. Just forget about it. Put that money into building better planes with better instrumentation, security, and only letting the right people ride on the plane. The plane, boss, it's the plane. You know, why would the Democrats, or why would the Republicans care if the Democrats boycott the inauguration? They know they all hate Trump and hate most of hate all these Republicans. Why would the Republicans give a shit whether these demo crazies and niggers all come down there to Washington? It's crazy. I think everybody should have the temerity to say, screw it, I'm not going down there. I don't like the guy, you know. Everybody stay home. Watch nigger ball. Yeah, we landed 4,000 troops over there near Russia. I'm going to put them right on the border. That's cute. That's wonderful. And most of these stupid Americans say, oh, that's great. We'll show the Russians. We'll show the Russians. Yeah. Seemed to me that Napoleon and Hitler tried that. Now 330 Marines land in Norway. Russia condemned the deployment, which meant to buttress the U.S. and its European allies' defenses against the country. If Russia decides to move west with their manpower and all their equipment and so forth, you are not going to do a goddamn thing to stop them. This is all just silly politics. Silly, very silly. 4,000 troops would stand in the way of millions of Russian troops. You're crazy, man. Putin must be laughing his ass off. Well, here's a bit of information you may not have heard about. Covert intelligence operations, propaganda, fake news stories, dirty tricks, all were used in a foreign government's audacious attempt to influence U.S. elections long ago. It wasn't 2016, it was 1940. And the operations were employed not by a hostile adversary, but by America's closest ally, the United Kingdom, just like now the Jews do in Israel. Through technology, though technology has advanced, and the two nations' motives could not have been more different, critical aspects of Russia's alleged covert efforts to bolster the campaign of Donald Trump echo the tactics of the British Secret Intelligence Service pioneered 7 decades ago. In 1940, as a war raged in Europe, British intel officers in New York and Washington worked to elect candidates who favored U.S. intervention, defeat those who advocated neutrality, and silence or destroy the reputations of American isolationists they deemed a menace to British security. Scores, perhaps hundreds of Americans who believed that fighting fascism justified unethical and at times illegal behavior, worked for the British intelligence or cooperated with the London's efforts. Winston Churchill's goals were as clear as Vladimir Putin's motives are murky. Churchill and the UK's savvy wartime prime minister knew that Britain could survive and repel an anticipated German invasion only if it received massive amounts of aid from the US, and that ultimate victory over the Nazis would require American military involvement. He also knew that the decisions to send food, fuel, and weapons across the Atlantic and to dispatch troop ships to follow in their wake lay in the hands of the President and a hostile Congress. To pull the U.S. into Britain's efforts would require first winning public opinion, propaganda, making newspapers and radio programs the front lines in the battle to persuade Americans to elect politicians willing to back Britain over those who promoted the America First SIS. The British intelligence agency flooded the American newspapers with fake stories, leaked the results of illegal electronic surveillance, and deployed October surprises against political candidates. You see? Over 18 months between Britain's humiliation at Dunkirk and the fact that Hitler screwed up there, he could have had their whole goddamn army. He let them go. And the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the scale of intensity of the SIS's efforts in the United States were without parallel in the history of relations between Allied democracies. In other words, the British were acting like our enemy, and of course they have on many occasions. The SIS and its American collaborators went to great lengths to obscure the ties between their activities and the British government. These links have since come to light largely because William Stevenson, the Canadian businessman who headed the British Security Coordination, BSC, the official front for SIS operations in North and South America between 1941 and 45, commissioned a history of the organization's operations. Declassified in 1999, that history provides a remarkable candid picture of London's espionage and propaganda activities. Whoa, wait a minute here. The story of British government's efforts to influence American elections and public opinion is a cautionary tale, providing a lesson that is all too relevant today about the power of propaganda and covert operations to alter history. It also demonstrates how difficult it can be to differentiate in real time between legitimate concerns and imaginary conspiracy theories, and perhaps provides a glimmer of hope about the resilience of the so-called American democracy, which it's not. American communists, fascists, and isolationists complained bitterly and loudly in 40 and 41 that Britain was secretly manipulating the U.S. media as part of a campaign to pull America into the war, which it was. These accusations, confidently dismissed by liberal politicians, and newspapers as paranoid ravings, were inaccurate only in that they were understated. Even the most alarmist commentators and conspiracy mongers underestimated the depth and effectiveness of British covert activity to get hundreds of thousands of American troops killed. British intelligence employed the full range of cloak and dagger techniques in America in 1940 and 41. Forgeries, seductions, burglaries, electoral dirty tricks, physical surveillance, intercepting and reading letters sent under a diplomatic seal, illegally bugging offices and tapping phones. British intelligence even listened in on a telephone call in 1940 between President Franklin D. Roosevelt in the White House and his ambassador to Britain, Joseph P. Kennedy Sr. A report on the call was quickly relayed to Churchill, alerting to him that the U.S. was making contingency plans in case the UK fell to the Nazis. While the British government strongly backed Roosevelt, it hedged its bets by working behind the scenes to increase the chances that the Republicans would pick a presidential candidate in 1940 who would join the fight against fascism. The Republican Party, lacking a consensus about a standard bearer or platform, was in disarray in June 40 as its national convention approached. BSC worked behind the scenes to smooth the path for a nominee who favored intervention. One element of BSC's operation surfaced on June 25th when the New York Herald reported on a poll convention delegates. Surprisingly, given the isolationist positions espoused by GOP stalwarts like Thomas Dewey, Robert Taft, and Herbert Hoover, the poll, which the Herald wrote, was conducted by Market Analysis Incorporated, an independent research organization, unquote, found that three-fifths of the Republican GOP delegates supported helping the Allies with everything short of war. In fact, Market Analysis Incorporated was anything but independent. Its head was Sanford Griffith, was an American who had secretly been working for British intelligence since the 30s. And regardless of the population survey, its polls consistently advocated U.S. interventionism in Europe. Among Market Analysis clients was the Committee to Defend America by Aiding the Allies, a group led by William Allen White, a nationally syndicated columnist influential among liberal Republicans. In this column, White wrote that the GOP delegate poll demonstrated that the leading Republican isolationists were out of touch with the party's members and that Wendell Willkie, who had not run in the presidential primaries, had switched his party affiliation from Democrat to Republican only a few months ahead of the national convention, best representing the Republican views, while all the other Republican contenders advocated steering clear of the war in Europe. Willkie argued that America's first line of defense is Great Britain. Let's see. In addition to Griffith's operation, BSC funded and coordinated the activities and messaging of a number of American anti-fascist organizations. One of these, an informal group of wealthy businessmen and journalists called the Century Group, operating during the campaign as a liaison between the British government, the White House, and the Willkie campaign. It brokered an agreement with Willkie to refrain from criticizing a proposal that allowed Roosevelt to unilaterally authorize the transfer of scores of mothballed destroyer ships to Britain. As the first president to snub George Washington's precedent of voluntarily stepping down after two terms, FDR was acutely aware of the threat posed by accusations that he was behaving like a dictator. Well, he was. So even the hint of such an accusation from the Republican candidate may have scuttled the deal. On August 30, 1940, BSC's agents secured Willkie's commitment to acquiesce to the transfer. Assured that he wouldn't pay a devastating political price, Roosevelt announced the deal at a press conference 4 days later. The BSC's work on Willkie's behalf was an exception. For the most part, it focused not on promoting candidates, but rather on defeating elected officials who opposed America's intervention in the war. Among those opponents was Representative Hamilton Stuyvesant Fish, a Republican and leading isolationist who had represented New York's Hudson Valley in Congress since 1920. By picking a high-profile target, the campaign against Fish was intended to put the fear of God into every isolationist senator and congressman in the country, according to a letter a BSC agent sent in the fall of 40. Oh, wait a minute here. To do this, the BSC created, funded, and operated the Nonpartisan Committee to Defeat Hamilton Fish, which, among other activities, circulated a pamphlet just opposing Fish, Adolf Hitler, and the Nazis. Another photo appeared to show Fish meeting with Fritz Kuhn, the American Hitler, who led the German-American Bund and was at the time serving a prison sentence for embezzlement. Contrary to the caption, Hamilton Fish inspecting documents with Fritz Kuhn, the Republican congressman, had never met privately with the Boone leader. The photo had been taken in 1938 at a public hearing that Hamilton Fish had organized to discuss a proposed ban on paramilitary groups like the Boone. Another bit of British engineering, engineered fake news, had an ironic twist accusing Fish of being a pawn of a foreign power. They alleged that the Nazis funneled money to Fish by renting his properties at an inflated high rates as a means of subsidizing pro-German propaganda efforts. On October 21st, Drew Pearson, the All-American louse, and Robert Allen reported the story in their hugely influential Washington merry-go-round. Though Fish won re-election, his margin of victory was just 9,000 votes, half of the size of his win in 38. In an after-election, after-action report to BSC and since archived at the FDR's Presidential Library, Griffin stated that the local Democratic Party had put practically no effort into defeating Fish and that an additional $2,000 or $3,000 a week or two headed would have been sufficient to put it over. Even after the U.S. entered the war, the BSC stayed on Fish's case, planting scurrilous stories in 42 that helped cut his margin of victory to 4,000 votes. In 1944, they finally beat him. Fish claimed it had taken most of the New Deal administration and half of Moscow, 400,000, and Governor Dewey to defeat me, quote unquote. As the BSC history later crowed, quote, he might, with more accuracy, have blamed the BSC. In addition to secretly intervening in campaigns, BSC funded and coordinated the efforts of the pro-intervention American political organizations and of associations of immigrants from Nazi-occupied countries that lobbied Congress and the public for a muscular U.S. response to Hitler. BSC also tried to shape public opinion by feeding a stream of true, partially true, and completely fabricated stories to sympathetic reporters and columnists. Some, like Edward Anser Moore of the Chicago Daily News and Ulrich Bell of the Louisville Courier Journal, worked directly with British intelligence officers, but most of the journalists who cooperated with BSC did so through American intermediaries. Among them was Walter Winchell, one of the most widely read columnists of the time, who routinely ran BSC items supplied by an intermediary. Well, I'm going to put this up on the website because there's some more to this, but I only run this because I want you to understand how the game is played. It's always played. Usually played about the same way. And so when you get your hopes all up for some new politician that comes along, forget it. They've got a million ways, if they're even honest, they can screw them. But most are already dishonest before they ever get there anyhow. So anyhow, that's how they did it back in 1940 to get the United States into the war and cause the deaths of thousands, hundreds of thousands of American troops. Nobody cares about that. That's in the past. As Obama says, I don't look to the past. We got to go forward. We got to go forward. Well, here's an interesting news item from Knoxville, Kentucky. Or was it Tennessee? Knoxville mourns on the 10th anniversary of the 2007 Christian Newsom murders. Well, I don't think they mourn at all. That's all. All that stuff about mourning and all that, I mean, I'm sure their parents and their friends mourn, but the rest of the people mourn? Bullshit. The case revealed that the young white couple were out on a date to celebrate the friend's birthday. They were carjacked, kidnapped, bound, beaten, tortured, raped, and slain by a group of niggers. At the time, many in Knoxville would not call this a hate crime. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? And most of them were probably white, which leads us to show that we're in a white civil war. Don't ever forget it. Much of your enemies are white. Don't forget it. Glenn Beck was doing a call-in show on hate crimes against blacks when a caller told him about the Knoxville case and asked why he wasn't covering it. Beck was speechless and promised to look into the 2007 slaying. He became one of the first national news figures to cover the Christian Newsom case and call it a hate crime. Of course it was a hate crime. Sure it wasn't a love crime. Recently, a Chicago crime went viral after four black people kidnapped and tortured a mentally challenged white man and videotaped the beating. The video shows the victim tied up, cowering down in the corner of a room while his attackers laughed and shouted political and racial obscenities. They were kicking and punching him and eventually cut into his forehead with a knife. Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson later announced that all four suspects were charged with hate crimes and several other felonies. The day after the presidential election, a white motorist in Chicago was beaten by blacks, calling him white boy Trump supporters. Pundits have questioned the validity of these cases being considered hate crimes. Who are these pundits? They ought to be drug into the street. This violence has propelled the nation into the debate over black-white crime. We're asking ourselves if blacks can be racist and charged with hate crimes along with whites. The answer is yes. Hate is found in the hearts and minds of people of every color and nationality. It exists in both male and female, and rears its head every time someone attacks another because of their color or beliefs or all kinds of other crap. Murder, beatings, and torture and so on are always hate crimes and should be applied without color distinction or social bias. Why? Because all lives matter. That was from a Knoxville paper. Well, that's true. That is true. But for this article even to have to be written is ridiculous. Many in Knoxville believe you couldn't call that a hate crime. One of the most heinous murder situations, rape and everything else that I've ever heard of. You know, the people who believe that shouldn't be classed as a hate crime need to be classed as a hate crime themselves. Of course, nothing should be labeled hate crime at all. It should just be crime. All this special labeling is strictly a Jew operation. And yes, it's a Jew operation. If you want to go back to I was there when it started in California, and I had turncoat people of my own organization help push it. So I was there at the hearings. I was there all along. And the Jews were all over those hearings. And a lot of the testimony, and I know the testimony of our turncoat, was all total lies when he claimed that he had been waylaid and nailed to a cross in the middle of Sacramento and left to die. Well, it never happened. It never happened. He went on national TV all over the place claiming that it happened. The Sacramento Sheriff's Department said, did not happen. And then he did it again. He did it again to get attention a few years later. So that's the way that goes. But the truth rarely comes out. The opposition don't like truth. They can't handle truth. Well, supposedly some of these regressive... All progressive groups are planning some bad shit at the inauguration, and here's a fellow supposedly undercovered some stuff. Hell, I don't know. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Let's see.
have freaking kind of butyric acid. I don't care how big the building is, it's closing. It's staying closed for a while.
And this stuff is, like, it's very efficient. It's very, very smelly. It lasts a long time. And a little of it goes a long way. I know. I'm trying to think through how to get all the freaking throughout the board. There's usually a piece of, like, fusel metal or a piece of glass or liquid in the middle below.
This is undercover video of potential criminal acts being planned. These organizers and activists are talking about setting off butyric acid into the ventilation system and setting off fire alarm sprinklers at a Trump inaugural ball later this week. What you're about to see is part one of our hidden camera investigation into the groups and organizations that seek to cause havoc and violence at the Trump inauguration in Washington, D.C.
I, Ronald Reagan.
I, George Herbert Walker Bush.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help me God.
Please lock the doors. Lock them. Lock them. Don't let them in.
Hey, I just want to say one thing to the person on the phone.
Can you please move
on
my way?
Regards.
The next 4 years, we are going to fight Trump and everything we stand for with no quarter asked, no quarter given, no mercy of any kind.
Throw them all under the bus. I mean, to the front, you know. I like the idea of the goal being that they have to pull the inauguration inside.
Be prepared to help make the inauguration a giant cluster fun.
Shortly after the election, we started getting tips that radical groups are planning to derail President-elect Trump's inauguration, perhaps even trying to shut down the city of Washington, D.C. Various groups, some old, some new, have gathered together under the Disrupt J20 umbrella. Progress Unity Fund, Workers World Party, Americans Take Action, Answer Coalition, and many more. Today's investigation focuses on these guys from the D.C. Anti-Fascist Coalition.
The message has to be that, you know, we do not recognize the city government either. If you try to close it down, we will look for your house, burn it. We will physically fight the police if you want to go to our place. We will go to war and you will lose.
Early on, one of our journalists was sent an email inviting him to a planning meeting. The discussion centered around disrupting the Deplorable, a big pro-Trump inaugural ball scheduled the night before the inauguration.
I mean, it would be really interesting if we could stop them from having the Deplorable on call.
It was at this meeting where we met Scott Green, Luke Kuhn, and Colin Dunn. They were very gung-ho and clearly well-versed in the dark arts of sabotage.
We already know what we're all there for, so we won't be saying, okay, so this is, we don't have to use the word Deplorable at all. Things like that. So just in case there are yahoos in there.
Through emails, another meeting was set up at the infamous Comet Ping Pong Pizza Restaurant in Northwest Washington, D.C.
I was thinking of things that would ruin the image, you know, ruin their outputs, or otherwise make it impossible to continue with their plans, make sure they get nothing accomplished.
The Deplorable is being held here at the National Press Club in downtown Washington, D.C. The plan: set off butyric acid stink bombs, forcing everyone to evacuate the premises.
Yeah, they had a freaking kind of butyric acid. I don't care how big the building is, it's closed and it's staying closed for a while.
And this stuff is, like, it's very efficient. It's very, very smelly. It lasts a long time. A little of it goes a long way.
So we can, the original stuff, we can use, like, all that same stuff. Then I can break the cans with a plunger and strip rubber bands and save the same thing. So all you got to do is pull the pin, press the plunger, and the whole can discharges.
We have to, this is why we have to brainstorm and think of what can we do. That will accomplish the mission. So that is bad enough. That stuff is nasty enough that it will spread to death. It will spread. It will get into the HVAC system.
The best possible location is
The actions could constitute a violation of anti-terrorism laws, a felony with a possible 5-year prison sentence and a significant fine. As the meeting continued, Colin Dunn and Scott Green made a plan to scout the location where the Deplorable is being held.
You want to get the place? I can do that.
I mean, you want to do it together?
Okay. It may work better with two people. That way, it's got one person's memory saying, here's where everything is.
Yeah.
There was also talk about setting off the fire alarm sprinklers in the building. Plan B, if the stink bomb effort failed.
I know, I'm trying to think through how to get all the triggers around the board. There's usually a piece of, like, fuse of metal or a piece of glass or liquid in the middle below.
I need to research to make sure that we can actually get an all trigger if we trigger one.
Yeah. Just like in the end, it benefits everybody as they walk outside and get free info.
Yes.
A few days later, our journalists received this email from Scott Green. Quote, "The reconnaissance went pretty well, and we left with the confidence that we can accomplish our objective with no negative consequences for our side, nor any collateral damage. We determined that the risks posed by these potential crimes were of such a magnitude that we decided to alert law enforcement. Last week, our journalists met with agents from the FBI, the Secret Service, and the D.C. Metro Police to report our findings."
We found that both the Disrupt J20 and the D.C. Anti-Fascist Coalition were plotting to shut down some of the inaugural balls that were occurring using butyric acid, shutting off sprinkler systems. So we're thankful that the FBI and the task force is looking into this, and we hope that there will be charges brought soon.
Just to be clear, we don't have a problem with people protesting peacefully or voicing their First Amendment rights. That's protected by the Constitution. But in this case, Disrupt J20 says openly that their plan is to shut down the inauguration. The question is, where do these people draw the line? Do these individuals and groups have any problem with what we're reporting here? Stay tuned, because next we go deeper and deeper into the dangerous world of Disrupt J20, and we find out just who is behind all of it.
I always love it when regular people try to explain crazy-ass biblical miracles. Like the one where they said that the sun stood still so that the Israelites could defeat the Canaanites. In fact, I think they said it reversed. Let's see what they said. According to a new research by Ben-Gurion University scientists, one of the physicists, one Bible scholar, one archaeologist, the miracle described in the book of Joshua, in which the sun and the moon stood still to provide a longer day so that the Israelites could finish off their Canaanite enemies. That shows you the arrogance and the vanity of these bastards. It was merely an eclipse that lasted 5 minutes and 15 seconds, which happened according to NASA's calculations on October 30th, 1207 BCE, 428 p.m., a.k.a. 1 Kislev, or 29 Kishvan. We have not seen the actual work, and so must rely on the reports on it in the Israeli media. Oh, sure. So that if the media got it wrong, we apologize. Well, number one, you can't even prove the goddamn battle occurred, yet alone the sun standing still. like the guy, one of the guys who was on my trip when I went over there to Israel, he said, well, if there was all these wars around here and all these Canaanites and died and killed and everything, where are the bones? The guy didn't know what to say. The tour guy didn't know what to say. Where are the bones? The answer's in the bones. The researchers suggested that what makes the biblical event unique is the fact that it mentions the role of the sun and the moon. Quote, "Then on the day God handed over the Amorite to the people of Israel, Joshua spoke to God in the sight of Israel, saying, 'Sun, stand motionless over Gibeon, moon, you too, over Avilon Valley.' So the sun stood still and the moon stayed put until Israel defeated their enemies, took vengeance on their enemies. The mention of both the sun and the moon led the three researchers to the conclusion that the text refers to a solar eclipse." Well, wait a minute. They talked to the sun and the moon, and the sun and the moon did what they wanted them to do. Anyhow, a solar eclipse during which the moon moves between the sun and the earth, blocking the sunlight. They checked the NASA data, discovered the eclipse, and published their results. The physicist, Dr. Hinzai Yitzhak, who led the team, has been contemplating that a bit of text from the book of Joshua for some time now, and his conclusion regarding the eclipse bears some merit, even though it appears counterintuitive. I would say so. Those of us who are familiar with the text as well as the Jewish tradition have always imagined the story as being about the daylight hours becoming twice as long. Oh, I see. Okay, just a minute here. This is getting interesting. Those of us who are familiar with the text as well as Jewish tradition have always imagined the story as being... Oh, I read that. What if what Joshua and his army needed was not more daylight, but instead more darkness? After all, they began their successful battle that day with a quick trek from Gilgal on the shores of the Jordan River under cover of the darkest night of the month. My question is, if this battle occurred there, where are the bones? Bones will last a long time. Rosh Kodesh is when the moon is usually unseen. It was darkness that gave them the element of surprise and the edge over their enemies. What if darkness is what they needed for the rest of the day? There are several problems with this theory. There sure as hell is. Not the least of which is the notion that the Bible offers a verifiable historical record. No, it doesn't. That Bible does not offer a verifiable historical record. The Bible is, first of all, a religious text meant to teach us moral values. It is also a poetry of several Jewish prophets, starting with Moses, who was Mises in Babylon, incidentally, author of the Torah. From its very first chapter, the account of creation, and well, I'm not going to read, go on and on with this Jewish propaganda, but there's still in schools, in Bible schools and so forth, and all these churches, they're still teaching this as fact. I kid you not, they're teaching that this, they had this battle out there, and they said, well, we need more light, so sun, stop. Moon, go. So we'd have more time to defeat the poor Canaanites. I say, I want to know about the bones. I don't even think that the battle ever happened, and we know that the sun and the moon didn't obey these kikes. You got to expose this kind of stuff, because they get away with it, and then they're teaching it in your Sunday schools and churches, still teaching this. All this gobbledygook is fact. Seen in the above, the 2016 electoral map of New York City is blue with dots of red. Trump's home district is blue, but across the water, a red wedge slices into Brooklyn. Around that red wedge are districts where Hillary won 90% of the vote and Trump was lucky to get 5%. Inside it, he beat her in district after district. The voters who handed him that victory are the Hasidic Jews of Williamsburg, who dress with fur hats and black kaftans. Their districts, crammed in by hipsters and minorities, are whirled away from the progressive activist temples whose clergy went into mourning at Hillary's loss. East of Prospect Park, in a vast sea of blue, is what looks like a red sofa. Trump won here with the Chabad Hasidim of Crown Heights. He won in the more mainstream Orthodox Jewish communities of Flatbush. He won by huge margins among the Russian Jewish immigrants of Brighton Beach, who listened to a man dubbed the Russian Rush Limbaugh. As the left-wing forward put it, nearly every election district that Trump won in Brooklyn was in a Jewish neighborhood, but it was a certain type of Jewish neighborhood. the wrong type, according to this guy. Hey, wait a minute. You can compare them to Rust Belt voters. A forward source states they are hardworking people, not college educated. And then in Far Rockaway, where the housing projects by the beach give way to the red Orthodox Jewish communities that extend into Long Island, there's a line that recurs again and again in the attacks on David Friedman, the man who picked by President-elect Trump to serve as the ambassador to Israel. It's not stated openly, it's implied. Quote, David Friedman, a bankruptcy lawyer from Long Island, is the sneering summary. Remnick, the New Yorker's left-wing editor, took the sneering to a new level, titled his smear as Trump's Daily Bankruptcy. Jewish identity, he declares, has never been a matter of bankruptcy law. To a certain class of elites, it is self-evidently absurd that a bankruptcy lawyer from Long Island be appointed to anything to be listened to about anything. David Remnick is a Washington Post man married to a New York Times woman who went on to inherit the editorship of the New Yorker and turn it into a left-wing echo chamber. He lives in a $3.25 million four-bedroom Manhattan apartment with a wood-burning furnace. And David Friedman is an Orthodox son of a rabbi from Woodmere who still lives there. His father was a Republican who hosted President Reagan. He might occasionally be allowed to read the New Yorker. And that's about it. Yet it's hard to think of anything that might recommend Friedman more to Trump. Well, that's enough of that article, but you can't be president of the United States without being totally surrounded by Jews. Do you understand that? It's not possible. And why the right wing and Duke and all these guys would go along with this bullshit, it's not hard for me to figure out, but it would seem to be hard to figure out. The right wing is so corrupted and so lacking of morals that, and also they'll grab at anything if they think it's going to advance a little bit of their cause. They're certainly not purist as far as racist is concerned, racial separatists. They're whores just like the others. They're whores. Most of the right wingers are whores just like the progressives. They could look in a mirror and see the same thing. Well, sorry, that's it. I'll be back tomorrow. And what is tomorrow? Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Have a good day and get ready. Get your popcorn ready because we're going to have fun as these the progressives and the regressives and all them go to battle on Friday. I can't wait. Can't wait. Operation Chaos signing off.
Cheer up, Ron. You know, as I say, some things in life they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle. And this'll help things turn out for the best. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten. And that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle. That's the thing. Aim always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's final word. You must always face the curtain with a bang. Forget about your scene. Give the audience a grin.
Enjoy it. You love it. So always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath.
Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you.
And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life.
Resting death is still you know.
Always look on the bright side.
You know, it's come from nothing. You got back to nothing. What are you doing?
Always look on the bright side of life.
Nothing will come from nothing. You know what I say?
Always look on the bright side of life.